My name is Paul Weber. Today, I am honored to have Dr. Carolyn Bridges join me for the teleclass, Influenza Transmission and Outbreak Prevention and Control Strategies. Dr. Bridges might very well be the absolute best person to give this teleclass. When I checked around, several people at the CDC specifically recommended her. In fact, the title of the teleclass was changed because Dr. Bridges suggested a better topic that she knew would make better use of your time over this next hour. She is a medical epidemiologist in the Viral Vaccine Preventable Diseases branch of the National Immunization Program at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta. To present the teleclass, Influenza Transmission and Outbreak Prevention and Control Strategies, I give you Dr. Carolyn Bridges.
Thank you very much for inviting me to give this talk. I will apologize in advance. Most of my examples are from the U.S. because that's what I know the best, but hopefully the overall messages will apply to many different settings. And I'll just start, and I'll be talking from the slide, so hopefully this will be easy for people to follow along. But there's a lot of information in the slides that you could look at later as a reference as well. In general, I'll be talking about basically the influenza impact. Then I'll be talking about specifics about influenza transmission and some of the data to support various recommendations for isolation precautions in hospitals and other healthcare settings. And then I'll talk about, in general, outbreak control strategies using the nursing home as the model. Influenza causes an average of 10 to 20% of people to become infected during a typical year, although many of those infections may be asymptomatic infections. In the United States, there are approximately 114,000 hospitalizations, approximately half of which are in people 65 and older. And there have been, during the 1990s, approximately 36,000 deaths per year on average, over 90% of those occurring among the elderly. Combined, pneumonia and influenza is the sixth leading cause of death in all age groups and the fifth leading cause of death among persons 65 and older. People who are at increased risk of complications from influenza include people 65 and older, and persons of any age with certain chronic medical conditions, including asthma, heart disease, lung disease, diabetes, renal failure, and people who are on immune-compromising medications or have immune-compromising illnesses such as HIV. Children on chronic aspirin therapy are at risk of Reye syndrome, so they are recommended to get a flu vaccine. And women who are in their second or third trimester pregnancy during flu season appear to be increased risk of being hospitalized for flu-related complications. In addition, some more recent data confirms older data, which suggests that children less than two are also at increased risk of complications from influenza. Healthcare-acquired influenza has been reported in multiple settings, including long-term care facilities, adult and pediatric general medical wards, and different kinds of specialty units, such as neonatal intensive care units and bone marrow transplant units. Particularly among very vulnerable, high-risk populations, influenza outbreaks in these settings can be very devastating, cause severe health consequences. Although these outbreaks typically occur while there's community outbreaks, they can also occur at other times of the year. Influenza prevention measures for preventing transmission in the healthcare setting include vaccination. Of course, this is the primary means for prevention. Vaccination should be directed at people at high risk for complications, but particularly important is vaccination of healthcare workers. Some studies have shown or suggested that healthcare worker vaccination can reduce patient deaths in long-term care facility residents. Despite the recommendation to vaccinate healthcare residents, to vaccinate healthcare workers, in the United States anyway, only about a third of healthcare workers get vaccinated against influenza. In addition to healthcare workers, the household contacts of high-risk people and other caregivers are also recommended in the U.S. to get a flu vaccine. Another possible prevention measure is the use of antiviral medications for prophylaxis, so this is certainly secondary to vaccination. And in preventing healthcare-acquired influenza, of course, use of isolation precautions and other measures such as hand hygiene is likely helpful. There have not been, that I'm aware of, specific studies looking at the benefits of hand hygiene in preventing influenza. However, a number of studies suggest that use of hand hygiene can reduce the overall number of respiratory illnesses. And in one study done in the military, 45% reduction in respiratory illnesses, medically attended respiratory illnesses, was noted. There are a number of different publications for guidance on healthcare isolation for influenza. The two that I note here on the slide are the 1994 Guideline for Prevention of Nosocomial Pneumonia and the 1996 Isolation Precautions Guideline. The pneumonia guideline is currently being updated and hopefully will be available in the next few months. These guidelines and other guidelines contain components of contact, droplet, and airborne transmission as recommended precautions to prevent transmission of influenza in healthcare settings. And some have also included the use of negative pressure rooms as much as feasible as another means to prevent transmission. What I'll be reviewing is what the evidence is for each of these modes of transmission. Just to make sure that everyone is using the same definitions, I've used the transmission definitions as outlined in the 1996 Guidelines for Isolation Precautions. Contact precautions, contact transmission is defined as either direct or indirect. Direct is body-to-body, surface contact, whereas indirect transmission occurs after contact with a contaminated inanimate object, such as a table. Examples of pathogens that may be transmitted this way include respiratory syncytial virus. Droplet transmission involves the transmission of infection through droplets greater than 5 microns. These are generally produced from the coughing and sneezing of infected persons. And these droplets are generally thought to be large enough that they don't remain suspended in the air. Those precautions to prevent droplet transmission include separating patients for at least 3 feet, but not necessarily putting people in private rooms. Private rooms would be preferable, but if they aren't available, then separating patients at least 3 feet. In terms of airborne transmission, examples would include TB or measles. These pathogens can be transmitted from evaporated droplets or infected dust particles that remain suspended in the air, and prevention of transmission then requires special ventilation. For influenza transmission, there actually are quite limited studies, and these studies have had varying interpretations by different reviewers. Both contact and droplet transmission have been cited as being probable modes, with contact being cited as probably the most likely means for transmission, although there is some evidence about airborne transmission being one potential mode as well. However, the relative contribution of each of these modes of transmission is unclear. And most of the studies are either animal studies or they're human experiments under artificial conditions, and then some outbreak investigations. Just to briefly review influenza pathogenesis, the typical incubation period is 1 to 4 days, although 50% of people infected with influenza may have asymptomatic infections. However, these people may also still be able to transmit influenza to others. Viral shedding is thought to begin as soon as 1 day before the symptom onset, and peak viral shedding or infectiousness generally is present for 3 to 7 days after symptom onset, and usually peaks 1 to 2 days after symptom onset. The greater the person's fever, higher the fever, the greater the degree of viral shedding that occurs, and presumably the more infectious a person is. Although most people shed virus for only 3 to 7 days, immunocompromised persons and young children may shed virus for much longer periods, perhaps 3 weeks or more. Being at all, looked at the survival of influenza viruses on surfaces, and he showed that on plastic and stainless steel surfaces, the virus may be recoverable for over 24 hours and may be transferable to hands for 24 hours. So this lays the potential for contact, indirect contact transmission for influenza. Cloth and tissue virus is not recoverable for as long, and it's more difficult to transfer it to hands. And the virus typically is viable on hands for less than 5 minutes, and generally only at high viral titers in these particular studies. I'm going to review now some of the data from animal studies, which is available. And some of these studies are quite old, so you really have to dig in the literature to find them. In terms of animal studies, Loosley and colleagues evaluated the infectivity of influenza in mice. They sprayed influenza into an enclosed room with an atomizer and constantly agitated the ceiling fan and then varied the humidity. They did not report the air exchange rate, but it's presumably quite low in this setting. And then they placed mice in the room for 20-minute intervals. And what you can see from the first figure is what they found was that at very high humidity, viral survival is quite limited, and mice were not infected after 1 hour. At more mid-level humidity, 48%, there was some infectivity of mice, even up to 6 hours after the room had been atomized with influenza virus. And at 22 hours at low humidity, they were still able to infect some proportion of the mice. And they were able to increase the number of mice infected if they agitated the room even further by raising dust off the floor. So these studies suggest that viral infectivity may be prolonged for even greater than 24 hours at low humidity, and this raises the possibility of contact transmission. And also the infectivity is increased after agitating the floor, which suggests that the virus may be viable on dry droplets and raises the possibility of airborne transmission. Whether this can be extrapolated to the human situation is unclear. Then Schulman looked at exposure of mice to infected mice. The uninfected mice were either in the same cage or in an adjacent cage separated by wire screens. They found that whether the mice were in the same cage or in an adjacent cage, they were infected at the same rate, suggesting that droplet and contact transmission were both potential modes. They also looked for evidence of airborne transmission and found that actually the ventilation rate in the room where the mice were kept was inversely related to transmission. Now to get to some of the human studies, Blumfeld and colleagues did an investigation of an outbreak of Asian flu in 1957. In this setting, of course, is a pandemic. There was little immunity, and there was a new subtype of influenza virus that was circulating, so one had a very highly susceptible population. An acutely ill woman was admitted to a four-person room with no isolation precautions, and there were 29 patients, none of whom were vaccinated, and 33 staff on the wards. In the hospital ward, approximately 50% developed illness, and of those that were tested, 70% had evidence of influenza infection. As hopefully you can see from the diagram, there's a schematic of the hospital ward, and the four-person room where the person was admitted is marked by a small asterisk. This patient was is nearest the bed. I'm sorry, the patient infected the patient nearest her in bed, and then also three healthcare workers on the first day after her admission. And then subsequent patients up and down the hallway, as well as other patients in the room, became infected 3 or more days later. The epidemic curve from this study indicates more likely that this is person-to-person transmission and less likely that this is a point source outbreak based on the distribution of illnesses by time. The authors hypothesize, and I would support, that this is likely evidence of spread by healthcare workers rather than blaming this on airborne transmission from the initial patient. The study most often cited for evidence of airborne transmission is a study by Moser. In this study of an outbreak on board an airplane, an acutely ill woman boarded in Homer, Alaska. This person stayed on the plane with severe coughing and fever and was found later to be infected with a new variant of H3N2 influenza, which was not included in the vaccine that year. The plane was detained on the ground for 4.5 hours, 2 to 3 hours of which the ventilation of the plane was turned off, so presumably there was limited air exchange, and there were 5 crew members and 49 passengers on board, some of whom stayed on the plane for the entire 4.5 hour period. The epidemic curve from this study suggests a point source outbreak and very efficient spread of this virus in the susceptible population. Approximately 72% of people had influenza, had influenza-like illness, and most of those were laboratory-confirmed when tested. This virus, though it was certainly very transmissible, in the household setting did not appear to be more transmissible than other influenza viruses, with the expected 20% secondary household attack rate. The conclusion from this study is that this appears to be a point source outbreak. Transmission occurred in a small enclosed space with low or limited air exchange. And because the index case in this setting was close to the airplane amenities, it's likely that all of these people, or most of them, would have had to come within 3 feet of the patient. So it's difficult, again, to say how much of the spread was airborne versus droplet spread. From other clinical evidence has been reported by the University of Virginia in a recent paper in The Lancet Infectious Disease. They do screening for influenza and very proactive in terms of using droplet precautions on patients admitted with flu-like illness. In this particular setting, they found rare cases of nosocomial influenza, even though they used positive pressure rooms, though most patients were put in private rooms and not in shared rooms. They hypothesized that the explosive nature of some of the nosocomial outbreaks is more likely due to a mobile source of infection, i.e. healthcare workers. And of note, of course, we know that nursing home outbreaks are controlled without special ventilation. Similarly, the University of Rochester has a similar experience. Unpublished data from Carolyn Hall is presented in the handout, hopefully, that you have. And in this study, what they did is they cultured infants for RSV and influenza every 2 to 3 days. They isolated RSV patients, but put influenza patients in rooms with 1 to 3 cribs per room. They did not find infections of infants across halls with influenza or in adjacent rooms, even though all doors were kept open. And most nosocomial infections in infants occurred in infants in adjacent cribs and not infants in the furthest crib in a 3-crib room. So the conclusion from these studies suggests that probably most spread is by large droplets and not by airborne, and that there may be a role for contact spread. So conclusion is from these studies is that contact, droplet, and airborne transmission are all possible routes of influenza transmission. The virus is transmissible after drying based on the mice studies. Some infectious particles are likely less than 5 or even 10 microns that are produced by sneezing. So this would present a mechanism for generating airborne particles capable of causing airborne illness. And it appears that infection rates are affected by low ventilation rates. Clinically, however, in healthcare settings, airborne transmission has not been obvious, and the healthcare worker appeared to be the most important in terms of spread. It's important to note that the benefits of negative pressure rooms for influenza have not been studied. So although airborne transmission may occur, the clinical experience suggests that droplet transmission is probably the most important. When one is considering how to isolate patients with influenza-like illness, obviously you'll need to consider what the risks and benefits are of doing that. If there is a new drifted variant and you have relatively few patients, then perhaps that would be a person that, if available, you might consider looking at the possibility of airborne precaution, isolation precautions. Or in particular, of course, if you had a new pandemic strain, and it was not circulating widely in the community, and you had adequate beds, and there was a possibility of preventing community spread of a pandemic strain. In that case, of course, one would want to do everything that you could to prevent transmission. One needs also to consider the susceptibility of the exposed population. If one is going to be around severely immune-compromised person, you would want to do whatever you could to prevent transmission to those persons. And, of course, one needs to consider the practicalities of various options, particularly in the case of community-wide outbreaks, when it is unlikely that adequate beds would be available for using airborne transmission precautions. So now I'm going to switch over and talk about general infection control strategies using the nursing home model. As I'm sure many of you know, nursing home outbreaks are quite common. Nursing home residents are particularly high risk of influenza complications because of their chronic medical conditions and general debility, and also because their response to influenza vaccine is decreased, their immune response. And also they're in a closed setting, which can facilitate rapid spread. When outbreaks in nursing homes remain uncontrolled, influenza attack rates of up to 60% have been noted. 25% of ill residents may be hospitalized, and 30% of those who are hospitalized may die of complications. Overall, mortality rates of over 10% have been reported. Healthcare workers are often implicated as the source of infection in nursing homes in particular. Some reasons may be that they often work while ill. That's been documented in several cases. And there's questionable compliance with isolation precautions, particularly hand washing or hand hygiene and use of droplet precautions. In general, as I've mentioned, vaccination rates are low, and so you may have, even though healthcare workers may not be ill, that doesn't mean that they can't bring influenza in if they have asymptomatic infections. One of the barriers to preventing influenza from being introduced by healthcare workers maybe that they have a disincentive not to report illness and come to work anyway. This may be because vaccination and sick leave are combined, so there's disincentive to take off sick leave days and reduce one's vacation time. There may also be financial disincentives, other financial disincentives, or the policy may be unclear or not enforced, possibly due to concerns about staffing issues. So in general, the vaccination rates for nursing home residents are high, but we may still see outbreaks even with high vaccination rates in nursing homes, and one reason is the inadequate immune response for many elderly, with vaccine effectiveness against flu-like illness in elderly being on average around 30 to 40% when there's a good match between the vaccine and circulating strains. And as I mentioned, certainly there are many ways that influenza can be introduced, not only by ill or asymptomatically infected healthcare workers, but also by visitors. Low vaccination rates may increase the possibility of introduction by healthcare workers. And in approximately 1 out of every 10 years, there is not a good antigenic match between the vaccine and the circulating viruses. For outbreak control in nursing homes, prior planning really is the key to minimizing impact. So means, of course, number one is to maximize resident and staff vaccination rates before the influenza season, and then to educate staff on the impact of influenza, the signs and symptoms of influenza, and how to diagnose influenza. Establishing a surveillance system to know the baseline rates of influenza illness and how to recognize increase in influenza illness among patients is very important for early detection. And having available testing to rapidly diagnose influenza when it's suspected. Having protocols in place for the prompt diagnosis and institution of control measures can also substantially help to reduce the impact. When one is considering surveillance for early diagnosis of flu-like illnesses and outbreaks, a number of different methodologies have been proposed. For surveillance, looking at influenza-like illness, some authors have suggested that if there is greater than 10% influenza on a unit, that that should prompt testing. Others have suggested that if there are three or more flu-like illnesses on a unit within 2 to 3 days, that that should be an indicator for testing and also use of control measures. And certainly if there are any lab-confirmed cases of influenza, that should generate action to initiate control measures. Also helpful to know when influenza is circulating or should be suspected is to develop protocols for screening ill healthcare workers and to restrict ill healthcare workers from patient care duties when at all possible. The rapid diagnosis of influenza is very important. Arranging in advance of the influenza season the type of testing that's available in the area, which laboratory would do the rapid testing if testing is needed. Having a supply of influenza testing materials on site can certainly expedite things. and educating the staff about indications for testing and how to collect and process specimens can facilitate rapid detection. There are a number of different kinds of testing available for influenza. Viroculture is the gold standard, but the downside is it takes several days to get results from culture, anywhere from 3 up to 14 days. However, viroculture does provide influenza isolates that can be evaluated for the type, whether they're influenza A or B, and what the antigenic characterization is, that is, how well they match the vaccine strains. There are a number of point-of-care tests that are available on the commercial market. In general, these are of lower sensitivity, can be as low as 50%, but they average around 70%, although the specificity is greater at approximately 90% or so. When using these to diagnose an influenza outbreak in a facility, we recommend generally that one use some of these rapid tests, but also confirm at least some of these with viral culture as well as a backup. Immunofluorescence is another means to diagnose influenza. This requires nasal pharyngeal swabs or throat or nasal swabs. It requires intact cells. There are some laboratory challenges, and this is best in my laboratory with skill and expertise in doing immunofluorescence for influenza. Serology is another means of diagnosing influenza, though this is used more for studies and not for clinical purposes because it takes so much time, at least 2 weeks, to diagnose flu by serology. PCR is available in some locations. It is quite sensitive, but its availability may be quite limited. Once influenza is diagnosed, control measures include cohorting influenza cases and persons with suspected influenza, and at least using droplet precautions and considering antiviral treatment of persons who are ill. We'd also recommend limiting group activities and also limiting staff from floating between wards so that you don't have staff who are symptomatically or asymptomatically infected transmitting influenza to other parts of the facility. Ill staff and visitors should be restricted from patient contact, and influenza vaccines should be reoffered to staff and residents who were not vaccinated previously. Antiviral prophylaxis of all residents and then vaccinated staff is also very important to control further spread, and one should continue to monitor for new cases and assess control measures as various control measures are put in place. The antiviral medications are very important adjunct for outbreak control, but they are not a substitute for a vaccine. They have been shown use for prophylaxis to limit spread. It's important, again, to initiate them quickly, and having a policy about the use of antiviral medications can speed rapid initiation of their use. For treatment, the antivirals can decrease the duration and severity of uncomplicated influenza if they are started within 2 days of symptoms. Though one needs to be very cognizant that some of these antivirals can induce drug-resistant viruses, and you need to be very careful about preventing spread of drug-resistant viruses at the facility. There are 4 antiviral medications that are available for influenza. Amantadine and rimantadine have been around for many years. These are effective against influenza A only, whereas the 2 newer antiviral medications, zanamivir and also tamivir, have activity against both influenza A and B. The approved minimum age for treatment and prophylaxis varies for each of these medications. In the U.S., zanamivir is approved only for treatment but not for prophylaxis. The other 3 are approved both for treatment and prophylaxis. Zanamivir is also different from the other medications in terms of its administration. It is a powder which is orally inhaled. The others are all pill or syrup form. The side effects differ substantially between these different medications. Amantadine in particular has substantial central nervous system side effects, and this medication needs to be dosed lower for persons of increasing age or with renal insufficiency. For rimantadine, the central nervous system symptoms are less severe, but it also needs to be adjusted based on renal function, hepatic dysfunction, and based on age. For zanamivir, there are no dosing adjustments that need to be made based on age, but there is some concern that this drug may cause exacerbation of chronic respiratory hyperreactivity, so this should not be given to people with underlying chronic lung disease. For oseltamivir, the primary side effect is nausea and vomiting. In clinical trials, this resulted in few people stopping the medication. This drug does need to be adjusted somewhat for persons with severe renal impairment. As mentioned, these antiviral drugs can be used either for treatment or for prophylaxis. If used for treatment, the recommended duration is 3 to 5 days for amantadine and rimantadine, and it's 5 days for zanamivir or oseltamivir. And again, particularly with amantadine and rimantadine, the emergence of drug-resistant viruses is an issue, and even though a person is on treatment, isolation precautions need to be continued. Again, particularly for amantadine and rimantadine. The emergence of drug-resistant viruses seems to be much less of an issue for zanamivir and oseltamivir. When these drugs are used for prophylaxis, they should be continued for 2 weeks at a minimum, and continued longer than that if cases continue to be noticed. After no new cases have been identified, the prophylaxis should continue for 1 week. And importantly, one would want to monitor for adverse reactions and possibly drug-resistant viruses, particularly with use of amantadine or rimantadine. The use of virologic surveillance information can help guide the use of different medications and even the different use of certain of the point-of-care tests for influenza. If you know if it's type A or type B that's circulating and what the proportion of each of those may be. It can help you in terms of interpreting the rapid tests and, again, in guiding which of the antiviral medications one may consider choosing. I've included in the slides a sample flow chart for facilities for influenza-like illness, and it's covered on that talk, and we'll just leave the flow chart there for your reference. Lastly, I'd just like to talk about a couple of examples of outbreaks of influenza in a couple of different settings to illustrate some of the points that we've discussed. One example is a long-term care facility outbreak, which was in a nursing home in Santa Clara County in 1998-99. During this particular year, there was a good match between the vaccine and circulating strains. Nonetheless, an outbreak occurred. The Department of Health was notified after nasopharyngeal swabs from 8 of 10 residents were positive by direct fluorescent antibody testing. The first staff cases of flu-like illness had occurred among 5 unvaccinated nurses in the week prior to any cases in the residents. Among the staff, approximately 11% had flu-like illness. Only 17% were vaccinated, and estimated vaccine effectiveness against flu-like illness was 72%. So that's quite high, particularly considering that ILI is a nonspecific outcome when you're looking at effective influenza vaccine. Among the residents, the first case, as I said, was a week after those initially had started in the staff. Over 95% of the residents, however, were vaccinated. 13% of them developed influenza-like illness, and 3 were hospitalized, 2 of whom died. One of those was an unvaccinated person. As you can see from the epi curve, the health department was notified fairly quickly into the outbreak among the residents. Within 24 hours, they initiated control measures, which included cohorting, reoffering vaccine, and the use of antiviral medications, both for treatment and prophylaxis. Within 2 days of initiating control measures, there were essentially no additional cases of laboratory-confirmed influenza. There was one additional case of flu-like illness in a resident. So, again, rapid control probably helped prevent the spread of influenza in this setting, and this was a very vulnerable population. Another example is in a different setting. This was actually a summer camp, and this outbreak was investigated by the Texas Department of Health. This was among a group of children, but this outbreak helps to illustrate the importance of using all of these control measures together rather than initiating one at a time. In this particular outbreak, there are a number of flu-like illness cases among some of the staff members. And then a new group of children came into the camp, and within a few days, there were increased febrile respiratory illness in the children. After third day, cohorting was started. Children who were ill were placed in separate cabins, and viral cultures were collected. This was in the summer, and so influenza was unexpected, and rapid testing in this case was not done. So it took several days for viral culture results to come back, and after those were returned, then within about 48 hours, antiviral medication was started and was combined with their efforts for cohorting. After that, there was a substantial drop-off in the number of flu-like illness cases among the children. But what this illustrates, again, is the importance of starting control efforts together, cohorting alone, particularly in children, but I think also in elderly, may not be sufficient. In most cases, it's not going to be sufficient to prevent spread. And also, this points out the importance of using rapid antigen detection to detect the outbreak early so that you can start the appropriate control measures, in this case, antiviral medication. I've listed a couple of additional resources for information on influenza infection control. There's a nice paper by Dr. Bradley, which was published in 1999, which has, I think, nice guidance about outbreak control. And isolation precautions and nosocomial influenza guidelines are available on the CDC website. In conclusion, influenza vaccine really is the cornerstone of prevention efforts, and efforts to improve healthcare worker vaccination are extremely important. Controls to limit healthcare facility transmission should include both contact and droplet precautions. For specific situations, airborne precautions may also be considered if appropriate and feasible. Setting specific outbreak detection and control plans are essential to limit impact of influenza when outbreaks occur, and these plans should include plans for surveillance, early detection, and rapid application of control measures, including the use of antiviral medications. And I will stop there.
Well, thank you very much for that. You mentioned that during an outbreak, often staff who are unvaccinated are offered a vaccine as well as prophylaxis. Is it necessary to vaccinate staff during an outbreak, or would prophylaxis be enough?
Well, considering that there may be 6 to 10 weeks of influenza circulating in the community, even once your outbreak is over, there may be other opportunities for healthcare workers to get sick and bring flu in later. There are lots of examples of nursing homes having more than one outbreak in a winter. So I would certainly recommend doing both. If you're not able to convince a healthcare worker to get a flu shot, then, you know, prophylaxis is certainly better than probably not doing anything at all.
If they get sick once, hopefully they will forever after get their influenza vaccine. I do want to thank you all for joining us. Before we get disconnected, I want to thank Dr. Bridges again for her very interesting and very useful presentation. If you are from the U.S. or from Canada and are interested in continuing education certificates, those are available, and I'd be grateful if you would contact me to find out how they can be available to you. This is a brand new program, and I'd love to tell you about it.